Chris is a highly active member of the Campaign Against Racism and Fascism. He's the author of many articles on understanding the growing kind of far-right threat in Australia and around the world, and a long-term socialist activist. So please make him welcome.
Okay, so this session, I should just perhaps clear up perhaps a little misunderstanding. It's not going to be just about the Proud Boys, this talk. It's not like some Marxist analysis of the Proud Boys, considering, especially given that the organisation has all but fallen apart, in the United States at least, and we saw what they were able to muster up yesterday when all five of their members in Melbourne rocked up outside our conference with a banner that said it was like West is best or something like that. So yeah, it's not going to be specifically about the Proud Boys, but I think the reason that the title of the thing, the session today, is Proud Boys because the Proud Boys here kind of seem to I guess kind of epitomize. Oh no, not that one. That one. We'll get to that one. But it is because they symbolize, I think, the kind of convergence that I'm going to be talking about between kind of men's rights activism, online misogyny, and also the far right. So we're living in a time when any woman in any field, but particularly in fields traditionally dominated by men, any woman who is perceived by the alt-right as being a bit too uppity, a little too, you know, above her station, is ganged up on, you know, turned into a meme, hounded, lied about, sent rape threats, death threats, and in most extreme cases, threats are even made to her family. And that's the relevance to this image. People might have seen in the last couple of weeks, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, this image was released. It's the first image of a black hole, a huge feat in science, and it took an incredible team of scientists to put this together, to, you know, an incredible application of human knowledge that has been accumulated over years and years and years, and creativity to bring this image into being, the first of its kind. And people might have also seen this image. This is Katie Bauman. She's an MIT postdoctoral fellow who, from 2016, led the team that came up with the algorithm to process the immense amount of data required to come up with that image, to visualize that black hole. So this image of her looking, you know, pretty pleased with the historic achievement that she's contributed to was uploaded by one of her colleagues. And when I saw this, I'm sure like when everyone in this room saw this circulating on social media, you would have felt what any normal person would have felt, which was, you know, it's this wonderful kind of candid image, and her pride at what she's achieved is so infectious, you can't help but kind of smile at it. However, if you are one of the sick minds that exists in the so-called manosphere, which is an online network of blogs, forums like 4chan, 8chan, and so on, and the people who frequent these spaces, men's rights activists, involuntary celibates, also known as incels, pickup artists, and so on, then you would have seen this image of a woman smiling at a scientific achievement and thought it was part of a feminist conspiracy that sought to assert female supremacy and to stop men from being able to do manly things like I don't know, write algorithms. So according to the pickup artist Roosh, in a series of tweets days after this image came out, he said, you can read it there, the black hole photo is almost certainly fake. I'm not good at Photoshop, but can create a more believable black hole photo. It only went viral because the news is desperate to pat a woman on the head for doing anything but make a baby. Now, Roosh is one of the many misogynists who dwell within this online space that I call the manosphere. It's kind of commonly known as the manosphere. His website, which as far as I know no longer exists, was called Return of the Kings. He was basically a catalogue of his kind of personal stories and advice on all sorts of topics, from travel to fucking women or to fucking women while travelling. That was the extent of his repertoire. And more than that, his advice rests on a notion, a pretty toxic notion, that men and women's roles in society are deeply rooted in biology and genetics. And so it follows that feminism and the women's movement have been harmful to society because, in his view, the movement for women's equality has upset the roles that both men and women are supposed to play. And it leads to, you know, uppity women, weak or androgynous men, and overall the degeneracy of the West. So by 2016, Bruce came out as a strong supporter of Donald Trump and has since abandoned his pickup artistry in favor of a career in political commentary. He recently self-published a book about, you guessed it, why straight white men are being denied freedom of speech. Now, it is this theme of male victimhood that I want to address in some detail. But before I get there, I want to go back to Katie Bauman. Like I said, we live in a world today where a woman who is a scientist, who expresses pride in the pivotal role she played in bringing about a kind of world historic achievement in science. And just for like a bit about her bio, she basically, when she was in high school, she discovered that there was this project to kind of visualize the first black hole. And she dedicated all of her like high school and university studies and everything towards this moment. So that's all she ever wanted to do. She's not even a political activist or anything. Her friend uploaded this image. Yet even she is not spared the vitriol of the manosphere. And after Ruch tweeted about Bauman, she came under sustained attack by Ruch's army of followers, plus other sections of the manosphere who were mobilized to attack Bauman. They said that she was taking credit for the work of her male colleague, and even when her male colleague that they labeled, came out and said this is not true, she did indeed lead this team of scientists. This was not enough. And it appears that facts and logic don't matter when the one true fact that you hold dear is that women are naturally subordinate to men. And it shouldn't come as any surprise to us that misogyny and sexism have long been an essential component of the far right's political framework. However, I think that the profound hatred towards women and it flows as well, hatred towards the LGBTI community and so on, bred in not only online spaces, but increasingly spilling over into the real world. If you think about that the Canadian incel who drove a van into a crowd of people in Toronto, killing 10. If you think about the gunman who killed 2 in a Florida yoga studio last year. You think of famously Elliot Rodger and his 2014 killing spree at a university. Even last year, the desecration by an MRA called Andrew Nolsch of a memorial to a young woman who was murdered here in Melbourne last year. You think of all of these incidents, and it's clear that the kind of the quality of the kind of misogyny, it's not just your run-of-the-mill stuff, it's far more grotesque and far more shocking than most of us could have imagined. And I think what we're seeing today is a resurgence of misogyny and woman-hating, and like I said, also tied up with that is a profound homophobia and transphobia too, sanctioned by people like Donald Trump, who, you know, a man who has routinely bragged about sexually assaulting women, who now sits in the most powerful kind of seat in the world. You've also got people like the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, who once said to a congresswoman that she was too ugly to rape. You've got these sorts of people sitting in positions of power, and it can kind of, you know, provide a catalyst and embolden things. But I think deeper than just these politicians, there is a convergence on the far right of what were once kind of disparate or separate movements. That is to say, on the one hand, movements of the far right, on the other, movements of misogyny that we could group together under the umbrella of, you know, anti-feminist or anti-woman movements, like the MRA movements, pickup artists, incels, and other misogynists. The far right, I think, have found in the manosphere an ideal recruiting ground of ready and willing soldiers trained in the practices of attacking their political enemies mercilessly and drunk on the ideology of hatred and also their own victimhood. Now, as I stated before, fascism has always had misogyny as one of its pillars. A common neo-Nazi symbol today, if people are familiar, is the numeral or the number 1488. The 88 in that numeral stands for, eight is the letter H, it's the eighth letter of the alphabet, and so the 88 stands for Heil Hitler. And the 14 in that stands for a slogan known as the 14 words, which goes, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And this neo-Nazi slogan is directly inspired by Hitler, Hitler's Mein Kampf himself, where he writes that we must fight to safeguard the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children and the purity of our blood. Now, under the Third Reich in Germany, the slogan Kinder, Küche, Kirche, or children, Kitchen Church, was part of an ideology that promoted the woman's place as at home with children in the kitchen and receiving moral instruction, you know, from the church and so on. And indeed, the Nazis, when they took power, took over women's organisations, which had once previously advanced the cause of women's rights, in order to perversely promote this new role for women under a fascist regime. Now, Kinderküche Kirche could just as easily describe a Victorian era view of a woman's where a woman's place should be in the home, and indeed the slogan existed before the Third Reich. And further, the idea that a woman's role is to reproduce for the nation is not a specifically fascist idea. It continues into the modern era. If people remember, you might not, but when Peter Costello was treasurer under the Howard government, he put forward a scheme known as the baby bonus, where a lump sum would be paid to mothers upon having a baby. And when launching the policy, he said that now mums would have an incentive to have not one, but three babies, one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. So while fascist notions of a woman's role in society might track pretty neatly with conservative thought, I would argue that what separates it is the way that it intersects with a kind of biological essentialism in defining femininity and a woman's role in preserving racial purity. And what's important is that when combined, for example, with the 14 words, the fascist idea of what a woman's role should be in society is reduced, to the reproduction of the white race. And even according to fascists, for example, people like Canadian alt-right figure Lauren Southern, one of the worst crimes that a white woman can do is miscegenation, that is being with a non-white man and reproducing, with a black man, an Arab, an immigrant, and so on. And so you can see that fascist misogyny combines with extreme race hate. And in a sense, this is one reason why the contemporary far-right abhors feminism in the women's movement. Women having more control over their bodies, over their sex lives, has been a long-standing demand of the women's liberation movement. Yet in the eyes of the fascists, this has undermined women playing their part in their historic mission. I say that in quotes. Historic mission. So these are the words from a recent flyer from the far-right Lega in Italy. And the heading at the top reads, 8th of March, who offends women's dignity? And it goes on to list a whole series of people who offend women's dignity. People who call for what they call pink quotas or quotas for women in organisations. People who call for affirmative action for women. Those who undermine a woman's traditional role in the family. And importantly, and I'll quote, those who support a political culture that claims an ever more marked and absolute self-determination of the woman that arouses a rancorous attitude and a struggle against man. Now, the reason it includes 8th of March in the title is because this was the flyer that the far-right Liga published and distributed just in time for International Women's Day this year. Now, another public figure who exalts women's historic mission to obey men and reproduce is Jordan Peterson, who was recently touring Australia to sold-out shows. Peterson has cultivated a largely, mostly male audience, even according to his own estimates. It's 80% of his audience are men. And whose best-selling book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, pitches itself as a self-help book, but actually contains some pretty dark and regressive ideas. What Peterson pursues is the idea that hierarchies of dominance are natural, they predate human societies, and those who attempt to undermine those hierarchies are not only doing so in vain, they're introducing chaos, which is an essentially feminine trait, into order, which is an essentially masculine trait. And so women, according to Peterson, crave male dominance, which is proved by psychology and biology, something that can be observed famously in The Nature of Lobsters, which, never mind the incredibly fallacious argumentation that means lobsters are arbitrarily picked out of all species on Earth to prove this point. And also that they're picked for comparison to human social systems. Peterson's point is not biological, though. It's political. He's attempting to push back against liberalism and its associated values and movements such as equality, the women's rights movement, and so on. And Peterson is an interesting figure because he captures this convergence, I think, as well, on the far right that I flagged. Peterson himself doesn't identify as the far right, and he's been pretty vocal about his distance from them. However, as I said, he has cultivated an audience with a very significant overlap with the far right. And recently, for example, this photo emerged. of Jordan Peterson at one of his shows at the New Zealand leg of his tour, in which he was photographed with someone wearing a T-shirt with the slogan, "Proud Islamophobe." Now, whether or not, Peterson, I think, is an Islamophobe, though he says he's not, but whether or not he identifies as one, he is more than happy to court these types and to, you know, to basically provide what I think is a pretty fertile recruitment ground for the far right. And more significantly than that, Peterson came to public prominence in 2016, where he picked a public fight over the question of trans rights. And I'll skip through this section, but it suffice to say that he did that very deliberately. The question of trans rights has been a talking point and kind of a touchstone for the far right, a hostility rather to trans rights. It's been a touchstone for the far right for ages. And he knew that he was picking a fight in which he would be able to self-style himself as a martyr for the cause and draw attention to himself. Now, while fascism has always had a misogynistic views on women, the convergence, at least in the English-speaking world, of men's rights activism and the far right occurred in a big way during the Gamergate scandal of 2014. Angela Nagel, in her book Kill All Normies, outlines some of this history, where women who worked in gaming, either in development or reviewing, came under sustained online harassment and literally just attacked for being women with opinions in gaming. The attacks were vicious, and like I flagged at the start, they were unique in that they were coordinated attacks on specific individual women who are subject to, you know, rape threats, death threats, threats against their family. It was during Gamergate that Milo Yiannopoulos first made a name for himself by stoking the attacks on and kind of egging on the attacks on women in gaming. And if you compare that to the treatment of Bauman, which physicist that I flagged at the start, you can see why Gamergate, I think, is a really important and formative moment in this convergence. It's where these kind of gaming misogynists online learned their technique of coordinated attack and abuse. They formed communities online around the issue, and with memes and irony being essential to the way they communicated with each other. And these patterns now learnt with a community now galvanized around ideas of misogyny and hatred, they were able to bring this over pretty easily once they started overlapping with more kind of nefarious far right types. And I mean, you can see that with the Christchurch killer, like the live stream and the manifesto was littered with such irony and memes that were circulating around the time of Gamergate as well. Now, I don't have. There's a book called Gender and the Far Right in Europe. It's a collection of essays, which I wanted to talk about a little bit. I don't know if I totally have time, but I think it's a fascinating book and people should check it out. And one of the arguments basically that's made in it is that, because one of the arguments that's often made about why is there this rise of this new kind of misogyny on the far right is that it's part of a kind of general backlash against feminism and against the advance of liberalism and so on. But one of the things they argue is that it's important to look at this within the kind of the social and kind of economic systems that are going on. And they pick Europe as a case study. And in their research, the authors of this collection of essays, Gender and the Far Right, found that movements against feminism were stronger, you know, lo and behold, where there was a stronger far right. On the one hand, it follows that in places like in Europe, where there has been a sustained campaign against a particular section of the population, i.e. Muslims, migrants, refugees, and so on, with the normalization of that oppression and racism and demonization, well, then you have that already operating in society, then that will be a society that is more willing to also demonize other oppressed groups as well, such as women and the LGBT community and so on. And I mean, that also accounts, I think, for the recent resurgence of things like anti-Semitism in Europe and the US. More specific to the rise of far-right misogyny, the far-right for years has been able to capitalize on the discontent that many people feel towards neoliberal institutions, such as the European Union, centrist or social democratic parties, and so on. And what has happened is that many of the gains that have been made in the social sphere by the women's movement, by the gay movement, have seemed to become incorporated in those neoliberal institutions. And so the case is kind of made by the far right that, rights are being doled out to special interest groups and so on by these institutions, the very same institutions that are attacking, you know, living standards, living conditions, and so on. But perhaps if people want to explore that a bit more, we can look at that in the discussion. An example of this kind of backlash is the movement which occurred in France in 2013 called Manif pour tous, which means protest for all. So it's this. It was a movement that was spearheaded by the Catholic Church. And it is the name for the movement, Manif pour tous, is a play on the French term for marriage equality, which is mariage pour tous. Basically, it was a movement spearheaded by the Catholic Church against a set of laws introduced by the then-president, François Hollande. And the laws included, you know, things like gay adoption, greater access to IVF, but famously, the provision for gay couples to marry. And the right-wing movement against the laws mobilised some tens of thousands across the country. I would guess that it is one of the biggest movements against gay marriage that the world has ever seen. And very early on, this movement was intercepted by the Front National, the far-right political party, now known as National Rally. Even though this party was headed up by a woman, Marine Le Pen, whose second in charge was a gay man, as part of the party's this was part of the party's move to kind of detoxify itself, to appear more palatable and respectable, not so Nazi-ish, it has always played a double game with the more conservative niece of Marine Le Pen, Marianne Marshall Le Pen, who is here, playing the role of villain. She's kind of based in the south, and she much more courts the traditional base of the far right, of the National Front. And this is her at one of the anti-marriage equality demonstrations. So the National Front provided political and financial support to this movement and tied the opposition of gay marriage with their opposition to the, you know, socially liberal but neoliberal economically government of François Hollande. Now, the fact that the effects of neoliberalism, deindustrialization, worsening conditions for ordinary people, closure of public services, whole towns left to rot, and so on, that could be tied up with an uptake in misogyny as part of a far-right program is also something that's commented on by an American author called Michael Kimmel. He's an academic in what's called masculinity studies, which, as far as I can tell, is just a branch of gender studies. But for Kimmel, the take-up of anti-women, anti-gay, men's rights campaigns by the far right and their supporters speaks to the weaponization of both male entitlement and male victimization coming together. Being a man continues to be associated with providing for a family. When jobs disappear overseas, when industry closes down in towns and cities, when working-class people, in particular working-class men, are no longer able to provide, then the far right and right-wing forces step in to provide scapegoats in the forms of, not just migrants, but also liberal inner-city elites who care more about, such frivolous things as, quotas for men and gay marriage over, their livelihoods. And I want to read a passage from an ethnography called Strangers in Their Own Land by an American researcher called Ali Hochschild. And she interviewed Americans living in the so-called Rust Belt, really impoverished parts of the United States. And this paragraph I'd like to read in full. She interviews someone, just a random guy called Mike, and I think it captures what Kimmel and others are talking about when they talk about this thing of entitlement meeting kind of victimization and how it turns against liberalism. So I'll quote, "And on the personal side, there was one more thing. The federal government wasn't on the side of men being manly. Liberals were certainly on the wrong side of that one. It wasn't easy being a man. It was an era of numerous subtle changes to masculinity, it seemed. These days, a woman didn't need a man for financial support, for procreation, even for the status of being married. And now, with talk of transgender people, what really was a man? It was unsettling, wrong. At the core, to be a man, you had to be willing to lose your life in battle, willing to use your strength to protect the weak. Who today was remembering all that? Marriage was truly between a man and a woman, Mike felt. Clarity about one's identity was a good thing, and the military had offered that clarity, he felt, even as it offered gifted men of modest backgrounds a pathway to honour. Meanwhile, the nearly all male areas of life, the police, the fire department, parts of the US military, and the oil rigs, needed defending against this cultural erosion of manhood. The federal government, the EPA, stood up for the biological environment, but it was allowing, and it seemed at times was causing, a cultural erosion. What seemed to my Tea Party friends to be dangerously polluted, unclean, and harmful was American culture, and against that pollution, the Tea Party stood firm. Now, the Tea Party, by the way, was a kind of insurgent movement within the Republican Party, which sought to put pressure on the party to nominate individuals in particular elections, which were aligned with its extremely reactionary and conservative values. And some would argue, as you know, I think is there's truth to this, that it was a precursor and helped pave the way for someone like Donald Trump to take the nomination of that party. Now, this is not to say, I mean, I read all of that out not to say that I have some sympathy with people who take this position, but I wanted to show the operation of how you can get kind of how these ideas can come into being and gain traction. Yeah, and the fact that it's, yeah, the Tea Party is identified as the kind of the political outfit that's kind of pushing this, yeah, I think kind of shows some of that. So another thing that Kimmel talks about is the importance of, yeah, masculinity, or at least the weaponization of male victimhood as a way of recruiting directly into the far right. So this is where we have a group like the Proud Boys, oh, finally got to the Proud Boys, who lent us the title for this talk. And anyone who's read about them or seen documentary footage on them would know that they operate seemingly like a college fraternity that we've, you know, seen in like Hollywood movies. You have to kind of pledge to be in it. You have to go through a series of bizarre hazing rituals. But importantly, it plays on the idea that men are not allowed to be manly anymore in society. And this is basically, the Proud Boys offers a somewhat safe space for men to be able to do that. And it's also combined with pretty explicitly kind of far right, if not kind of fascist ideas. Thanks. So members have to pledge to defend Western civilization and to be in the top tier, to be a top tier member of the group, you have to beat up a leftist. So just as Jordan Peterson uses the guise of self-help to recruit men who feel victimized into a worldview that tracks closely with that of fascism, groups like the Proud Boys operate on a very similar, along a very similar dynamic, even if they are a little more extreme. Here in Australia, by the way, there's also, this is, someone was telling me in the campaign, there's a group called Blokes Advice, which waits around men's mental health centres, seemingly to address the issue of men's mental health. It's, you know, whatever, it seems innocuous. But then it's been reported by people who actually work in the field of men's mental health that these people are quickly recruited into far-right ideas. And the group Blokes Advice actually spawned from a Facebook group, which had to get shut down because it degenerated into just like the most vile kind of like misogynist and kind of rapey kind of memes, or like kind of revenge porn style posts. So then, it, you know, and one of the things that these kind of groups like MRAs and so on often say is men need rights too. And for example, they cite things like men's overrepresentation in suicide and mental health statistics as victims of war, and the fact that men often lose out in custody battles. However, I think these arguments are, like, we should be pretty staunch and pretty clear about picking apart these arguments and not ceding ground to them. Firstly, on the question of men being victims of war, yeah, that's really fucked. That's why you should be against imperialism and against war. Like working class men and women, yeah, should not be cannon fodder for our ruling classes, but also innocent people overseas should not have the smithereens bombed out of them, because of what, you know, the West or whoever wants to, what their imperialist interests are. On the case of things like custody, because, like, just to go back, the men's rights movement in the 90s emerged from disgruntled fathers who had lost out custody battles. The thing about that is it's a minority of a minority of cases that end with custody battles where the father wants joint custody and the mother wants sole custody in any case. And almost always this is for legitimate reasons, because the father is being abusive or she wants to move to another state or something like that. But what about the question of men's mental health? And this is where I think you can get a glimpse into what I think is kind of irrational irrationality of the far right. Because the idea is that men suffer worse mental health outcomes because society places too much pressure and too much burden on men on the shoulders of men, too many expectations and so on. And actually, on that score, many people who are, you know, feminists and, you know, whatever, people who would agree that things like the gender binary and gender roles, rigid gender roles in society, including the masculine role to provide and to be stoic and not display any kind of feminine traits, like emotion, these things are fucked. And is probably a reason why men don't actually choose to access mental health services. But this stems from the oppression of women. This does not stem from the oppression of men as men. And however, the MRAs point the finger not at society's rigid gender roles, but rather at feminists and the left who are waging a war on masculinity, the very same masculinity that is leading, apparently, to men killing themselves en masse. But more often than not, however, what the MRAs point to as evidence of men's oppression is actually just things like working class oppression. So in the US, anyone earning less than 34 grand a year has a 50% more chance of committing suicide. And the unemployed in the US have a 72% more chance of committing suicide. In the UK, those working as a tradesperson or in a low-skilled profession have the highest rates of suicide. More than gender, it's poverty that leads to poor mental health outcomes. And the MRAs and the far right are further exposed as crying crocodile tears when it comes to men from oppressed groups. So they don't care about black men, for example, who are gunned down in the streets of the United States by police, who have a 1 in 3 chance of ending up in the criminal justice system. They don't care about gay men who are 6 times more likely to commit suicide. They don't care about Indigenous men who in this country, between the ages of 25 to 29, have the highest suicide rate in the world. And are the social group who have they have the lowest life expectancy in this country. Men for the far right means straight white men, and the problems that afflict the working class as a whole, in all of its genders, colours, sexualities, are contorted to fit with a straight white male identity. The far right has weaponized for its own political gain. And as much as these people rail against identity politics, these people practice identity politics better than anyone else. Now, what to do? So I think as the recent Christchurch attack on Muslims shows, the unifying enemy of the international far right continues to be Muslims, continues to be refugees and migrants. There are examples of the far right, including women. In the case of Germany, a lesbian woman was the head of Alternative für Deutschland, the leading far right party there. Yet the issue that unites the far right across the world is extreme nationalism against the fifth column of Muslim immigration. And I don't think that will change anytime soon. However, we need to recognise that movements against women and the LGBTI community are no longer simply movements in themselves, but more often than not are a flag or a warning sign of some sort of far-right involvement tracking alongside or influencing it. So this means for the left, we need to firstly reassert our commitment to fighting around these causes. So this is a picture of a few comrades, my Monash comrades. At the last year, there was a thing called a March for Men, which the far right organised. And like I outlined, they said that it was just about marching for, poor fathers, marching against such toxic language as deadbeat dad, and for men's mental health and so on. But we shrewdly identified that this was being coordinated and organised by the far right. The Proud Boys were actually in attendance at this. And so we organised a counter-protest to that, and that's obviously the counter-protest. And so we need to reassert our commitment to fighting around these causes. We can't capitulate to the idea that women's rights exist for some enlightened, inner-city elite, and that's the preserve of those types, while the working class in the suburbs, their issues are kind of separate to that. We have to reaffirm that women's rights are part of working-class struggle. They're working class rights. Gay rights are working class rights. We have to recapture these demands away from, kind of neoliberal institutions and so on that might use them as progressive cover and kind of incorporate them as part of, a working class program. But more importantly, I think we need to rebuild a radical left, an anti-capitalist left, that can give to working class people what the far right is attempting to offer, a sense of dignity in a world that continues to rob ordinary people of this basic quality. Now, I think the far right, it's kind of fallacious. Like, they're not actually trying to do this, but they can give a sense that they are. And for us, dignity, like all rights, are strengthened when it's forged in collective struggle for a better world. And so there's a battle for which of these worldviews will win out. And that battle is raging at the moment. So I think, just to finish, we have to fight to make sure that our side, our worldview, our strategy, which sees a vision beyond the limits of capitalism, is the one that's successful.